welcome to episode 222 of Board Game Blitz, a podcast about all things board games that you can listen to in less time than it takes to boot up a PC running Windows Vista. Board Game Blitz is sponsored by Gray Fox Games. This week, we're interviewing David Bresnik, the president of the United States Professional Mahjong League, who will be chatting with us about all things Mahjong. And now, here are your hosts,
Amby
and Crystal, plus our special guest,
Dave Bresnik.
Well, thank you so much, Dave, for joining us on the show today. We are so happy to have you.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here. I always love talking about Mahjong with people, bringing the game to more folks.
For our viewers and listeners who do not know who you are, can you just kind of give a quick, brief little biography of yourself, explain who you are and a little bit about your background?
For sure. So my name is Dave Bresnik. I have been specifically a Ricci Mahjong player since around 2006. In 2010, I formed the U.S. Professional Mahjong League, which was the first Ricci or Japanese Mahjong organization in the United States. From there, I have worked with the World Ricci Championship Committee to build a world championship for Japanese Mahjong to help grow the game. We ran our first event in 2014 in Paris. I hosted it 2017 in Vegas. Another one was 2022 Vienna, and we're moving on to 2025 Tokyo. And in the past year, we opened up Sparrow's Nest Studio in Manhattan, which is a public Mahjong parlor here in New York City, in the heart of New York City. It's one of the only public Mahjong venues on the East Coast.
That's really awesome.
Wow.
It's been a journey.
I can imagine.
Really cool. So I've talked about Mahjong on the podcast before, and I recently got into Ricci Mahjong last year, I think. Before that, I grew up playing Hong Kong style Mahjong with my family. But like, what got you into Mahjong and specifically Ricci Mahjong?
The short answer I always give to that is spite, which is kind of a funny story. In around 2006, I first heard about the game in any way because of actually a fan sub of the Akagi anime. And I thought to myself, oh, here's an anime about Mahjong. Could that be cool? And then I watched it and it was like really, I mean, it was really like over the top dramatic. That entire series is very like incredibly.
It feels like there's an anime about everything.
Yeah. Well, it was actually during this era where they had like Hikaru no Go, where they were making anime about classic games to get people reinterested in them. So they were trying a lot of stuff like that.
That I almost got into Go because of that anime too. I watched some of Akage after getting into Mahjong.
And so like coming out of this, I was like, oh, this sounds cool. I'd like to try playing this game because I like games in general, all kinds of games. And that's when I hit this weird block where there was very little material available in English about how to play Japanese Mahjong. And that's where the spike comes in. I was like, it's 2006. We have the internet. Like, I should be able to learn to play this game. And I started digging. And I found that the European Mahjong Association actually just published a rule set for Japanese Mahjong with the help of some folks that I then met and some Americans who moved to Japan to become professional players, Jen Barr and Garth Nelson and Gemma, now Gemma Sakamoto, who works with me on a lot of things. And they all worked together to build this. And so I got these rules and I grabbed three of my friends and I sat them down and I said, we're playing this game. And it took us like 6 hours to play our first game. You know, we didn't know what we were doing. We were all terrible. We were just starting. But we just kind of kept doing it. And we kept doing it for like 3 or 4 years. It became like a Friday night tradition for us. Every Friday night we get together and play. And that's kind of how I started, like launch myself into doing more things with Mahjong and learning to play and getting started with it.
Wow, that's cool.
That's awesome. So other than Ricci Mahjong, are there other forms of Mahjong that you have gotten into over the years as well? Or do you pretty much just stick to the one form?
Ricci Mahjong is definitely like my first love and my specialty and the one that is nearest and dearest to my heart. But especially in opening Sparrow's Nest, which is kind of a broader Mahjong community space, I played a lot of Hong Kong. There's a lot of people in New York who love Hong Kong Mahjong, and I've grown a great appreciation of Hong Kong. It's super, super fun. And, you know, obviously in my own heritage, my own grandmother and many people here in New York as well love playing American Mahjong. You know, they love getting their card and sitting down with their racks and playing American. And so that's something I've kind of learned to appreciate as well.
I've never played American Mahjong, but like my friends had played like different variants of Hong Kong Mahjong, and like there's no rule set for it that's consistent. Everyone has their own like, oh, we do this and this and this scoring. And yeah, so I think when my husband Toby was looking up Mahjong rules, like last year when we were getting into Mahjong, he was looking up Ricci Mahjong, and I think he probably found your site because I think when I mentioned to him that we were going to be talking to you, he's like, oh yeah, I remember seeing that or something. Like, oh, because yeah, like we chose that because it had like rules, like actually specific rules that were consistent.
That's one of the really interesting things. I found that like for Hong Kong Mahjong and most of the Mahjong played in China, what I kind of describe it as is like a rule soup. Like there are a lot of options and then everyone kind of plays with some subset of the options that they've chosen to like, but there's not a lot of standardization. And one of the things that actually with the World Ricci Championship, we worked really, really hard to do is we've gotten all the professional orgs in Japan organized around a single rule set. And we've have like a well-written competition rule set that is, you know, maintained, and you can really access it if you have questions or problems. And that's been a huge, huge boost to the game.
That's really cool.
So I imagine since Mahjong is kind of like a thing that gets passed down through the generations, though, is it one of those things where you can run into kind of unique rule sets depending on where people grew up or like where they live or like, because I know here in the US, like with card games, you might name a game with a certain name and depending on where you lived growing up, you might know the rules a little bit differently than other people. Is it similar to that or no?
Absolutely. I mean, just to make sure I cover the bases properly, like Mahjong fundamentally is a Chinese game, was invented in China, first appeared around 1850, actually. The game was very, very popular and spread very, very rapidly throughout all of China and then throughout actually a lot of the rest of Asia. And because, you know, it's 1850 and you have this game being passed on person to person, someone comes back, you know, from wherever they were and says, oh, I learned this cool game. Here's how we play it. And then locally people say like, I don't like that. Or maybe we do that differently. And like it mutated a lot around kind of a core set of rules. And so definitely you're going to find different regions have different traditions, have different rule sets, have different things they like to do and not do. You saw tiles get added to and removed from the game. I have certain sets that have, they call them catch tiles. There's like a cat and a mouse, and they're used kind of like flowers. Like if you have the mouse and you have the cat, and the cat can grab the mouse from the person who has the mouse. In Taiwan, they play with three extra tiles in their hand. In Malaysia, they play with very, very large tiles. Yeah, there's Filipino mahjong, all kinds of variants because there was no central rule authority specifically within Japan. Because there was that like growth of the game into this like professional scene and more standardization, you saw those rules start to get, you know, people wanted to structure them and write them down a lot more because competition became kind of almost like a sport. But in a lot of other places where Mahjong seen much more as like a social game or a home game or things you do with your friends and family, there wasn't really that strong of a drive to standardize. Although there have been attempts at doing that in the past. There's modern Chinese rules, MCR, there's Zhongzheng, there's a few other rule sets. But really, I think Japanese right now has the most standardization. And for a lot of other people, it is a very social thing. In America also, I should mention, the National Mahjong League does have like a standard rule set for American Mahjong that is kind of fairly well enforced and fairly well known. Although people in that community have a lot of opinions about which rules should be enforced how. There's definitely a lot of like how we do it in our house there.
I mean, I feel like with any game of this ilk where there are rule sets, people are going to get nitpicky at times because especially if you are doing competitive play, you kind of have to some degree. I've really enjoyed seeing over the past, I would say, couple decades especially, but over time, games from the Eastern world have become more well known in the Western world, especially here in the US. When I was growing up, the only Mahjong I had heard of was the solitaire Mahjong from Windows Vista. So, like, that is what I thought Mahjong was for a very long time. And then I learned, no, I mean, it is, but it's not. Like, it's a very, you know, it's a simple version of Mahjong. And not just Mahjong, but other, like, board games have started coming over more from Japan. And I know I had heard from a Japanese board game designer at one point that he didn't realize that there was appetite in the United States for his games. I don't know if that's a cultural barrier or a language barrier thing or just a lack of awareness, like just, oh, like I'd never tried, so just wasn't aware. Do you think that if Mahjong was more accessible within the United States, that it could become more widely popular?
This is like right up my alley. I think there's a few things. So a lot of what we do is we teach people to play Mahjong. We were just at New York Comic Con a week or two ago, and I think by the numbers, we taught 1,000 people how to play at New York Comic Con. Wow. So Mahjong is a popular game. People like it. When people sit down to play it, they have fun for the most part, like 80, 90%. Obviously, no one loves everything. I do believe that, like, first of all, we're seeing this kind of renaissance in the United States, particularly of people just enjoying playing physical games with other people, like sitting down to do something in person with their friends, socializing and pulling that together. And I think Mahjong has that core element to begin with. But I also think there's a lot of like intrigue and drama within the game that's very exciting. And it kind of reminds me when I was a kid, you know, you'd look in the newspaper and you'd see like the bridge strategies. Now this, I'm dating myself, but yes. You see like, you know, every week they'd be like, oh, the weekly bridge strategy. You had bridge is this very social game that families would, you know, that married couples particularly often would they be each other's bridge partner. They go and they sit down with other married couples. That's how they socialize. They sit down and play bridge.
I was going to say, I remember my grandma and grandpa talking about going to bridge night. So.
Yeah. And I feel like Mahjong can really fill that same niche where it has this really social aspect. You need four people to sit down and play. And within the structure of a game, you know, you can have a nice time talking and chatting. And I think the final thing that makes it really fill that niche is that, like, it's not like chess. I always tell people it's not like chess, right? In chess, if I sit down to play chess versus Magnussen, I will lose. lose because Magnuson is amazing at chess, and I am for sure not amazing at chess. I will lose again and again and again, over and over, and it will be kind of dispiriting for me, although maybe I'll learn something, but it'll be sad. But Mahjong is very much like a long tail game. There's enough randomness in the game that really anyone can win any hand. A good player at Mahjong will win like over 100 games, far more than someone who's not good at Mahjong, for sure. But every hand is an opportunity, and that keeps it really fun. And so even if you're not amazing at the game, you can still sit down and you'll win sometimes, and you'll have a good time, and you'll laugh, and it won't be such a foregone conclusion, and you're excited and engaged. And I think that's really a great ingredient in a social game.
I agree. Yeah. That's a good point.
I remember the first time I won a hand when I was playing with my grandma. But like I did play, that was like very simple, like no scoring rules, just like trying to get out as a kid. I was just so excited because she would always like just laugh and win.
That's a good grandma right there. Like, ha-ha!
And also she knew like all these other scoring things and would say things. But like my mom's vocabulary, she speaks Cantonese. Like her vocabulary is like a 4-year-old. So she didn't understand any of it. So my mom couldn't understand how to play the game. And like, so that's why we didn't play scoring. But yeah, I remember like my grandma would just win all the time. And then I won like once. I was like, oh, yeah.
So would you say that professional competitive Mahjong is still significantly more popular in Japan than in the United States at this point?
Yes. Oh, for sure. Like, you're nodding. For sure.
Yeah.
Just simply because of like how endemic it is. I mean, when we're talking about professional competitive Mahjong, I am going to kind of focus that on Japanese rule set Mahjong. I know there is Mahjong Masters in Taiwan, but other than that, I'm not really aware of any attempt to seriously professionalize competitive play. So I'll put that kind of bound on what I'm talking about. But of course, because it's endemic within Japan, the market for it's much larger. APEMA has M League, and M League is like kind of like an esports-ized version of Mahjong. It's televised regularly. People there watch it a lot. People here watch it because it's one of the most accessible broadcasts of that kind of thing. And what we don't have here in America is that level of like endemic knowledge of the game that would lead people to be interested. Again, personally, do I believe it? I mean, I've spent 14, 16 years on this. I definitely do believe that that there's like a ripe interest that could be grown here in America for something like that, because it is a very exciting game to watch. But one of the big challenges is it's not a very easy game to watch if you don't know how it's played. So like building up that knowledge is kind of key to that.
Yeah. And then I imagine if more players are Japanese and you don't happen to know Japanese, I imagine that the language barrier can be somewhat of a hindrance.
So for gameplay itself, actually, the language barrier is something we're working on getting over that hurdle. For example, on the WRC YouTube channel, we have, I'm going to be doing this in a couple of weeks, we have English commentary on games. So we have the Yukon Fuji is this very large tournament run over many, many months. And we've actually sponsored a team to be in Yukon Fuji. And so we rebroadcast their games in English with American commentators talking about what's going on. And that's something that's been really, really successful. People are really excited because it kind of breaks down that language barrier.
I read that you all at the USPML have actually like taken players over to Japan to learn from Japanese professionals. I would be curious to hear how an event like that goes.
What we did there, we called it the Crash Course, and we brought like a group of, I believe it was 12 folks over to Japan. We ran two of them before. Unfortunately, the pandemic kind of shut it down. And so that was kind of an arranged program with translators available to kind of go back and forth and like help the people from the West get their questions translated to Japanese and get their responses translated back from Japanese into English. And it was really, really successful. It was really interesting. We learned a lot about how people engage with the game, which is a little different from East to West and different kind of cultures and backgrounds and how they talk about things. But it was a huge opportunity for people to learn from people who really do this day in and day out, like what their thinking is and what their strategy is. So it was very enlightening on many fronts.
That's really neat. And I imagine that the people who participated, like that's got to be just a really cool opportunity and thing to get to participate in.
Yeah, it was really exciting for them. It was really exciting for me to be part of the facilitating team. And we're actually looking to see if we can do the reverse and actually bring some folks over to New York to teach here for folks who want to do that, but can't necessarily travel all the way to Japan for a week or two.
Then you can bring in a lot more Western players and say, here, we got all the pros right here. Come on, you want to learn Mahjong? Yeah. You know you do.
Yeah, exactly.
So how often do you play Mahjong, and do you like play other games too? Or is it just like all Mahjong now?
Well, now that I run a Mahjong parlor, I play Mahjong like pretty regularly, like pretty much all the time. Like if people need a fourth, I'm sitting and playing. So I'd say like a lot. I think like I was in for 3 or 4 hours last night. People maybe play Mopai Mahjong, which made me cry a little bit. That's when you play without your eyes. You keep your eyes closed and you just feel the tiles with your thumb.
Wait, what?
Yeah, it's
I haven't tried that yet.
I need more information.
So one of the things that I always tell people is every time. Oh, is that an Amos Master set?
Yeah.
Oh,
we
very
imported
cool.
It
very
from
cool.
Japan. but I awesome. Can show. It's got grooves in the tiles, like.
So the game becomes a tactile exercise then?
This is not like a serious thing people do. This is a thing people do for fun. It's not like, okay. Yeah, but yeah, because the way the tiles are made is, you know, it's carvings and then ink goes in the carved thing. So you can feel a tile with your thumb and you can run your thumb over it and get a feel for what that is. And if you play, I always tell people, every time you draw a tile, just run your thumb over the face and you will start to get a feel for some of the tiles after several years. So if a few folks that I know are really, really... If you just do it every time, you don't even have to think about it, but if you just do it every time, you will eventually get a feel for some of the tiles.
This one's pretty easy.
Yeah. That one I was good at, yeah.
For audio listeners only, I'm holding up a blank tile. One of the tiles is just blank. There's no grooves in it at all.
We can identify that one.
Yeah.
So they play with, you put a blindfold on, and so you get dealt a hand, and all you can do is feel it, and can you actually successfully play by only feeling your tiles? I've been playing for so long, I thought I would be better than I was. Uh-huh. Like, it was real embarrassing for me. But
people can actually do that decently?
Yeah, half decently. I mean, I think the folks who were successful have been doing it for, like, the past 3 days solid. Like, they just been doing this for, like, multiple days trying to get a feel for it.
Yeah, because, like, in the anime, Akage, there was, like, the blind one who was feeling it and then, like, cheating, you know?
some of the old guys, I've met some of the old guys who can do that very, very well.
Oh my
like,
gosh.
They're legit good at that. And I'm just like... I think one of them, many years ago, one of them told me the right way to shuffle, and this is one of those classic like old guy lessons, but he said the right way to shuffle is with your hands up, with your hands entirely palm up, so that it's clear that you're not touching the tiles at all.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. This is one of those like old fashioned like gambling den sort
wow.
of lessons that he had.
That's fascinating. Let's go into the world of make-believe for just a moment. As the president of the United States Professional League, if someone were to come to you today and say, here's $1 million, you know, it's for Mahjong, the Mahjong community, however you want to use this money to that end, what's the dream for you? Like, what, if you had the means, what would you do right now as far as Mahjong in the United States?
Oh man, you're asking me all the questions I ask myself every day. This is great. So I think the key things that I really want to develop in the United States, number one, I think would be an online platform for play that meet a few specific criteria I have that is geared for Westerners, geared to pull in Westerners and be kind of entirely English native. I think that would be the number one thing that I would do with some of that. And then number two would definitely be like either some combination of basically forming a league, like a decently high-end broadcast studio and the ability to like have regional teams compete in a real league. I think those two things combined would probably be the biggest steps forward that I can think of off the top of my head. That and or franchising parlors into more places, but that's maybe more expensive than just $1 million. But
mythical amount of money, basically.
Oh, then heck yeah, let's franchise all across the country. Let's go. Like,
right?
I got a blank check.
Like with the studio, I'm imagining kind of like the poker boom of the early aughts where people started watching, you know, the World Poker Tour and the World Series of Poker more regularly on ESPN and on other networks. And like, I'm picturing people watching Mahjong, like glued to their TVs watching Mahjong tournaments or something. Like, that would be really neat. And I think an online platform for Mahjong seems pretty doable, honestly.
It's fairly doable. Yeah. There's like a few quality hurdles to get over to make it a product people would be interested in. And to make it a product and really stand up against some of the competition. But I think something really geared towards Western players, European and American players that was English native would be a huge help.
Absolutely. Yeah. I that would help me learn it because I don't own a Mahjong set and I don't think any of my friends own one. I'm sure my friend Greg that owns the most games of anyone I know will send me a text after this episode when he listens to it.
Just
if
like
he
I have
owns
one.
A Mahjong set.
Oh yeah.
Even if you do own a Mahjong set, it might not be like a Japanese Reach set.
Reach
so.
Mahjong, yeah.
Although, I mean, you could play it with like a Hong Kong set.
Yeah, I think Reach requires the smallest subset of tiles of everything, actually.
Yeah.
Like, Reach requires very few tiles. Also, I forgot to mention, I do play a million other games. Like I'm at that point in a board game collection where my primary thought about board games is I need to get some out of my house to make room for next year's Gen Con haul. So
what's your favorite other board game?
I will have to say that like Pipeline, Capstone Games' Pipeline.
Oh, nice.
Actually was the game that like reignited my love of board games. Like I've been a collector for a long time, but in the scene for a long time. And I felt like games have been trending on this, like, cause I'm like a big, heavy game guy. And I felt like games have been trending towards this like lighter, faster for a while. The hobby grew and many more people got into it, which is great. And then when Pipeline came out and I played it, I was like, oh yeah, this is it. This is what I like. So I'm a big, big Pipeline fan.
Nice.
Yeah. It almost feels like it goes through waves, right? Like a trend comes along. I almost feel like the pandemic kind of mixed things up in a weird way, and I don't quite know where things are now for most publishers. It's harder to keep track of what the trends are, aside from trick-taking games, which are everywhere right now, and I am not complaining
about that. Yeah, they're really popular. Really popular.
I love trick-taking games, so I'm so stoked.
I am bad at trick-taking games. It's funny, I got like, I forgot who published it. It was this big pile of trick-taking games. It was like, there was, and Sale, actually Sale as a cooperative
board game tables now.
Yes. I got their like big stack of trick-taking games, and like I like all of them, and I'm terrible at all of them, but I actually enjoy them very much. I think they're excellent games.
Sale is such a good game.
Sale's really cool.
I love Sale. I actually haven't reviewed it on the podcast. Maybe I should. I don't know if you, this is going to sound weird at first, but I don't know if you're familiar with the YouTube internet show Hot Ones. There's a YouTube show where Sean Evans makes people eat hot wings and answer questions. And he's a really good interviewer, truly. Like, I think most interviewers could learn some things from him. And there's one segment that he does in a lot of his interviews where he says he does a deep dive on his interviewees' social media. So I went digging through your Twitter account, and I found a tweet from 2016 of picture of a double rainbow that you posted, which I thought was adorable. And so my question to you is, what's your favorite internet meme?
What have I done? Double rainbow. Oh my God. Yeah. What is my favorite? That's another
I was like, he's probably going to think I've got some weird gotcha. It's not that. Don't worry.
Yeah, I'm like, I'm pretty sure I never posted anything actually shameful on my
Twitter.
So
honestly,
I guess we're good.
It's a lot of we're live streaming right now, so it's I found a really nice picture of a double rainbow, so
it's hard. What is my favorite? That's a tough one. I feel like recently it's been the like weird like guy on the side of the party, like nobody knows I something or another meme. I don't know how like deep internet that meme is, but I think that's been the one that I've liked a lot lately.
I mean, it's one of those things where like things will seem very popular in certain corners of the internet, right?
Yeah.
I used to have a coworker. We determined at one point that he and I lived on different sections of the internet because the things I knew and the things he knew tended to be different. So we would come and tell each other the things from our other side of the internet.
Oh, I was also big on like, don't ever talk to me or my son ever again for a while. That was a good one. That's old, but that was a good one. I liked that one.
There are some that have some real staying power for sure.
Yes.
So the USPML, you're based in New York?
Yes.
Is most of the stuff you do just live with people in New York, other than like the big events that you, like the Worlds in Las Vegas and stuff that you did?
So right now, most of what we do ends up being like New York in-person events. We do New York Comic Con. We're going to be at PAX Unplugged. We do Otakon in DC also, because Otakon really likes having us there for Mahjong stuff. Mm-hmm. They're great. It's one of the things like I'd love to do more like nationwide conventions and stuff like that, but it is like a lot of time and expense, so it's challenging. Yeah. And I don't want to like abuse my poor volunteers that really put their heart and soul into helping us out with this. We're also going to be running in January the U.S. National Qualifier for the World Championship in Tokyo. So basically the top 64 players from around the U.S., as per this qualification cycle, we'll be coming to Sparrow's Nest to do the final qualifier to see who gets to go to Tokyo, and we find out how many seats we get for that next year.
Cool. Ooh, that's cool.
It's going to be an intense tournament. People are going to really be putting their best in.
Oh, for sure. I'm excited to hear about it when it happens, and maybe even try and look up some of the coverage of the event in Japan.
Yeah. That's like something that I would want to go to if I didn't have kids.
Those silly children getting in the way of everything.
It's time and responsibilities. You said you started playing Reach. Like, where? How did you get started? And where have you been playing? I might as well ask a question in return.
So I played Hong Kong, like Mahjong, basic Mahjong, as a kid with my grandma. She's from Hong Kong. Then a couple years ago, we played. Like, I have a lot of friends who also play their versions of Mahjong, and so like we had played with some people who are all similar levels to us, and we played but like with actual scoring kind of. Then we're like, oh, this is a lot more fun when we actually like care about scoring. and then someone had like more official Hong Kong rules that they were teaching us, and then we were like, oh, we should all get into Mahjong together and we should get a set. And then my husband Toby looked into Mahjong, and when he looks up stuff, he like look super deep into it. So he was like researching.
Toby does not half booty anything.
Yeah. So he was like researching what to get, and I don't remember exactly like what happened, but he looked up stuff and decided that Reishi was the best one. And so that's what we were going to get. And it had rules and stuff. And so we ordered the Amos Master Set from Japan. And actually, we didn't have a table yet. We got a table more recently. And Yeah, we played Mahjong Soul, okay, which is okay. One of the apps that you play online. It's very anime heavy, so like
I might turn off some people.
But when we started watching Akage, but we're only partway through. We kind of ran out of time and stopped watching it, but we should have watched that more. But yeah, like it was my favorite game of last year. Like new to me game, like yeah, because we played it a bunch, and it's been cool like getting into it with people who are all like the same. We're all getting into it together. It's a lifestyle game.
It's funny. Yeah, my friends who I started playing with, mm-hmm. like, I mean, they're still my friends for some crazy reason. And like, I think two of them have cracked top 32 at the World Championship. No, wow. I'm sorry. One of them has. The other one won uh-huh. some other tournaments, but not specifically the World Championship. But like, yeah, it's funny. Like we've had this whole like journey for like so long just mm-hmm. by doing this thing together, which has been really cool.
Yeah.
Okay, so I would say the majority of our listeners are probably based in North America, likely in the United States or Canada, but we have listeners in other countries as well. But let's say somebody's listening to this podcast and they're now like, I want to learn more about Mahjong. I want to play Mahjong. What advice would you have for them as to what to do first?
Okay, that's a great question. So you want to play Mahjong. First of all, your best bet is to see if you can meet other people around you who want to play Mahjong, because not everyone is as lucky as me and has three very tolerant friends who will let them, you just drag them into playing a game, right? Now, what I can suggest is if you go to narichi.org, that's narichi.org, that's the American Reach Association. I happen to also be a board member of that association, but it's got a list of all the clubs that we found in North America, or at least in the United States, I believe. So if you're in the United States, you want to play, that's your first step. You can find a club there maybe near you if you're near a major area. If you're trying to learn on your own, I'm going to stick to my preference for Japanese Mahjong and say you can go to the World Reach Championship site and download the World Reach Championship rules. You can play on one of the many online apps. Tenho.net is, again, it's got a little bit of a language challenge, but it works. There's an app called Kemono Mahjong available for Android and iPhone and on Steam, actually, that lets you play. And Nintendo's Clubhouse Games for the Nintendo Switch also has a great implementation of Reach Mahjong. When I first started playing, one of the things I did, I got a copy of Mahjong Fight Club for the PlayStation Portable. That's an import, so that's a little harder to find. The great thing about all those games, about Kemono Mahjong and Clubhouse Games, is that they let you play without a timer, which is really important for beginners. When you're playing in a lot of these online games, they give you this really strict timer. And if you're learning, 15 seconds is not enough time to figure it out. But being able to sit there and just play a game against AIs with no timer, taking your time and playing through, that's really how you're going to start developing. Because many people have asked me over the years, like, how do I get good at Mahjong? And the only answer I ever have for them is you play more Mahjong. Mm-hmm. Like, there's no shortcut. The other thing I would recommend to people once you're past kind of that beginner, what am I doing stage, is like a perennial classic is Ricci Book 1 by Dina Chiba. It's available for free online. You can download it as a PDF, but it has like a real set of like core theory and strategy for you to start really digging into the game and understanding like what your decisions mean and how to really interpret what you see in your hand.
That's awesome advice. Thank you so much. Well, Dave, it has been an absolute pleasure having you on the show. If people wanted to reach out to you online, you have any social media where people could potentially reach out and say hello?
For sure. You can find us on Instagram at USPML or at Sparrow's Nest Studio. And if you want, you can always email me directly, dave@uspml.com. My inbox is generally open to folks. And those are really the best ways to get at me, I think.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure to be here.
And that's it for this week's Board Game Blitz. Visit our website, boardgameblitz.com, for more content and links. This episode was sponsored by Gray Fox Games. Champions of Midgard 10th Anniversary Collector's Edition is the ultimate edition with all new art, every expansion and promo, and tons of upgraded components coming soon to Kickstarter. Find out more at grayfoxgames.com, where you can also use the code BGBLITZ24 to get 20% off any non-exclusive items. Join the Blitzketeer community on Discord for game nights, discussions, and more by following the link in the show notes. Support the show by leaving us a rating and review on your podcast provider. And if you like us a lot and want to support us monetarily and get some cool perks, check out our Ko-fi at ko-fi.com/boardgameblitz today. Our theme song was composed by Andrew Morrow. Until next time, seekest thou the tile to complete your last set? Gather them all close, it isn't your turn yet. One away as you play, waiting to be drawn. Now exclaim the sumo came, you got a Yakumon. Bye everyone!
Bye!
Yeah, because like I've never played. Wait, what? Was that just a sneeze?
Yeah, I sneezed. Did the audio? Did Zoom actually edit out the audio?
It was like a. It was some weird thing. I don't know. It was like a whoo or something.
Oh, thanks, Zoom. There's now we've already got a blooper, so perfect.
Nice.
10th anniversary collector's edition is the ultimate edition with an. I wrote this and I can't say it.
And I was making such fun reactions.
Oh,
too.
I didn't see you. I was just looking at the thing.
Ignore me. I'll mess you up.
Okay.